Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
How are you?
I'm well. No more double espressos for you before the show. No more double.
My intro was a little bit more animated
actually,
today,
the
wasn't
engineer
it?
Is still waving at me. He's turning your levels down. You're a little high on life this morning. That's good. We're going to talk later on with David Wondrich, one of our favorite writers on cocktails. He has a new book out called Imbibe, and it's fascinating read. And it's like, look, I know we have recipe books, et cetera, et cetera. This has got over 100 recipes in it, but you can sit on the beach and read it straight through. It's a history of cocktails. Fascinating book. All right, so that's for later. I want to start off with something I'm PO'd about a little bit here.
Oh, golly. I always hate when we start off a show with you PO'd about something.
No, I'm not really PO'd, but I don't know. We're in the I told you so mode.
You look incredulous as well.
It's happened again.
Uh-oh.
I want to read. You know, I don't even know where this is from, so I can't attribute it. Well, we can go on. If you're interested where this comes from, I'll let you know. But I emailed it to myself, and I guess I left off the tag. There's an article that appeared, well, somewhere.
We do know it appeared April 4th.
It says, the next new flavor makes the scene. Pomegranate has now had its reign. What's the next it flavor on the cocktail scene? Okay, first of all.
Pomegranate's around hundreds of years.
Well, no, but pomegranate had its reign. It's like the new thing.
Mm-hmm.
We started making our own grenadine 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, out of pomegranates. And
so it's not over, is that what you're saying?
Why
it's still
don't
got
they
some,
just
got
say,
some legs?
But no, what I'm saying, well, if we're first... I know we're in Jersey, but can't someone just acknowledge that we were first? Can't someone just acknowledge? Okay. And here's another one. This is going to make my head pop off. The next new flavor, it seems, is elderflowers.
Oh, my goodness.
For the Hollywood opening of Ocean's 13, George Clooney ordered 800 elderflower cocktails, like pomegranate, elderberries, and elderflowers are said to have health benefits, and like Pama, the pomegranate liqueur, the elderflower has a champion in the new liqueur Saint-Germain. Now, Saint-Germain is a very good spirit.
And a new liqueur. Relatively a new liqueur.
And it's a relatively new liqueur. But we have been making drinks and sorbet and soups with elderflower syrup from Austria, from our friends at the Nikolai Hof Winery mm-hmm. in Austria, since, what are you going to say, 96?
10 years, 12 years is about right.
96.
That's about right.
We've been making cocktails with elderflower syrup since 1996.
Well, and to be fair, the Austrians have been doing it for a lot longer than that.
That's correct.
Okay? They really have been doing it for quite some time. Elderflower syrup is not the new magical thing that's just fallen from the heavens on us.
Tough being in Jersey. Elderflower syrup is non-alcoholic, and it's traditional in Austria. And I first traveled to Austria in 96 and came back with a mm-hmm. case of it. And we've had it imported ever since. We've always had it in the restaurant.
Oh, it's great. It's...
makes a great sorbet. Works wonderfully in summer soups. And, yes, we're using it in cocktails. And in Austria, traditional... In Austria, I said that with a Jersey accent. Austria.
Austria.
Austria. The traditional way to use elderflower syrup, and we've used it, it's very refreshing, is you pour a little bit of the elderflower syrup in a glass, fill it with club soda, and you've made your own elderflower soda.
Non-alcoholic, delicious, no corn syrup, tasty, sweet, spectacular.
Well, here we are.
Summer cocktail.
Elder is now showing up in restaurants in the United States. British-based Pret-a-Manger sells Elderflower Youth, a soft drink. Smoothie chain Elderberries in Roanoke, Virginia offers elderberry flavor, and even Dunkin' Donuts now has an elderberry smoothie. I think I'm going to kill myself. One of our most popular cocktails uses elderflower cordial, says Holly Roberts, a mixologist at Amalia Restaurant and Lounge in New York City. The drink muddles the cordial with black cherries and gin. Sounds pretty good, actually, and it is a pretty good cordial, but I just want to say we got there first.
Well, it's not new. The news that people are using elderflower out there, and it's become a hot new thing, is true. People are beginning to see the value of elderflower and elderflower syrup. But again, the Austrians have been doing it for a long time, and they showed it to us a long time ago, and even some of the great chefs in New York have been using it for a while.
Yeah, but not as long as we have.
But not as long
Sorry,
as
am
we
I
have.
Being petty?
A little. You're being a little small, Francis.
Nanny, nanny, poo-poo. We were there first. Okay. All right, so you know, here we are. I want to say it on the radio. I'm going to make this prediction because I've been trying to make this happen now for a while, and it's difficult, but I've got some coming on my wedding. I have some friends who have a blackthorn bush bringing me some of these from Ireland. The next flavor in the cocktail world, and look, it is April of 2008. I'm going on the air, on record, and on the internet as saying the next flavor will be slowberries. Slowberries are the fruit of the blackthorn tree. And it is what you make slow gin from.
And they have the name already. We got this slow food movement.
Right, exactly.
We're gonna follow suit with the slow berry movement. Because what do you eat for dessert at a slow food dinner? Slowberries.
I'm just telling you.
Slowberry ice cream.
Slow gin fizz. Now the thing is, the slow gin that's available out on the market right now is mm-hmm. not very good, and tastes to me tastes very artificial. We're going to make our own slow gin. Now, if any of you beat me to it, I'll be really mad. I've done it in a very small batch, and it's very delicious. So my friend Lawrence is going to bring me some. Lawrence and Anne-Marie, I should say, as well, is going to bring me from their slowberry bush, or from their blackthorn bush, some slowberries. We're going to infuse that into gin, and we're going to work with the slowberries. Problem is, I can't get any slowberries domestically. And they're going to make jam and bring in the jam because they mm-hmm. can't bring in any live fruit.
Because they can't bring in live fruit, correct.
So they're going to make
I was wondering why you were telling on your friends for smuggling.
No, they're going to make it preserved.
Before they actually did it. I thought that might be a good way to get them in a lot of trouble.
No. Well, so you know what the other thing that you can make from a blackthorn tree. Do you know this, by the way?
I don't know. I know very little about the blackthorn tree. I'll be very honest with you.
It gives us so many wonderful things. It gives us slowberries. And it gives us blackthorn walking sticks, which are the best walking sticks in the world.
Sure.
And also, do you know what is made from a branch, a specific kind of cured branch of the blackthorn tree?
Can I guess?
One of the hardest woods in the world.
Can I guess?
Go ahead.
A shillelagh.
That's correct, sir. That is correct.
You are nothing if not predictable.
I don't know how you got that, but it's great.
I'm sure it was the smirk on your face that gave it away.
A blackthorn walking stick is one of those walking sticks. It's got kind of a polished knob mm-hmm. on the end of it. That polished knob is the root where that branch joins the main trunk of the tree, and we take that out, we cure that wood. It's one of the hardest woods on the planet, and then you polish it. And what a shillelagh is, it's a weapon, actually. It's like a short blackthorn walking stick with a leather thing around the end, and that polished knob, rather than being your walking stick, is what you hit the guy over the head with. And the problem with the shillelagh in Irish defense is the British had guns.
Yeah, and or even knives and swords at the very least.
Exactly. We'll be back in just a moment with David Wondrich talking about his new book, Imbibe. It's one of the best cocktail books written in 2008. He's actually been nominated for a James Beard Award for it, and we hope he gets it. 1450 WCTC, time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. David Wondrich is our guest today. He's widely recognized as one of the world's foremost authorities on cocktails and the history of cocktails. He is, along with our buddy Dale DeGraff, one of the founders of the Beverage Alcohol Resource. He's worked with the Museum of the American Cocktail extensively. He's authored several books on cocktails. His latest book, Imbibe, has earned him a James Beard nomination, and he joins us today to discuss that and the state of cocktails in general.
David, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
So, David, you're one of my favorite people to talk to about cocktails. You really bring a broad frame of reference. So while you put yourself through bartending school while dabbling as a professor of comparative literature, I understand.
Well, actually, I never went to bartending school.
I was using hyperbole. I figured you'd run with me.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. No, I don't know how to work a cash register. I was never a bartender, sadly.
But
I came to this later in life.
I think I've had a couple bartenders who work for me who didn't know how to work the cash register either.
Yeah, but one of they the claim great to be bartenders.
One of the great dangers of being a restaurant owner.
Well, but the joke there is, of course, that you are a professor of comparative literature. You have your PhD, mm-hmm. and most people become a bartender while they become a professor.
No, I did it the hard way.
And you were a professor while you became known as one of America's leading cocktail experts.
Well, you know, I was a professor for 4 years, and I absolutely hated the job. I enjoyed grad school because they were basically paying me to read books, and that's pretty pleasant work compared to all the other odd jobs I'd had. But once it came time to actually grading papers and sitting on faculty conferences, et cetera, I started looking around for something else. And just at that moment, a friend of mine had a little writing assignment for Esquire's website, and he knew I liked to make cocktails, so he asked me if I could do it. And I said, sure, and took a look at it, and I said, wow, this is the most fun job I've ever had, and I'm still doing it, so not so bad, right?
Well, now, you're the wine columnist for Esquire magazine, right?
Yes, yeah, so spirits, cocktails, beer, occasionally wine, whatever they need.
And your first two books are Esquire Drinks and Killer Cocktails, both excellent books.
Well, thank you.
You know, it's funny. I like to collect old books, and I have a number of at home Esquire cookbooks from the 50s, 60s, mostly.
Yeah, they used to do them regularly.
And they're full of wonderful advice. I remember there was sort of a, you know, the 60s Esquire cookbooks had sort of a bachelor pad vibe to them, you know.
Yeah, they really did.
And one of the great pieces of advice, which is actually it's good advice, and I do it all the time anyway. But it suggested said the single man should always have a bottle of champagne chilled in the refrigerator. Just in case.
Just in case. No.
Let me help you with something,
just,
Francis.
Just in case they fail to meet anybody nice, yeah, and
exactly,
need something to console themselves with.
I have news for both of you. The married man should also have a bottle of champagne.
That's true. Well, I can't because my wife will drink it.
Oh, I see. You need a secure section of the refrigerator.
I do. It has to be under lock and key.
So, you know, the thing, though, that's interesting to you, and sort of in the firmament of the American cocktail contemporary cocktailians, you have a place, and you know, this is a contemporary people who are there is a generation of people now, I think, with Dale DeGroff and Tony Ebuganim and mm-hmm. Julie Reiner and Audrey Saunders and yourself and Ted Haig, who have sort of reestablished the cocktail in American culture, and maybe you're the historian of to give us our perspective, as well as one who makes cocktails. One of the things these people have done is to put the cocktail in context, and it really is inseparable from the context of American history, isn't it?
Yeah, it's part of American life. It always was, and in the periods when it wasn't, it should have been.
You know, exactly.
It was the first thing that it was the first cultural thing about America that the rest of the world wanted. I think that's just so great.
But yeah. how important is the perspective and the history to what's happening now?
Well, I think it's actually surprisingly important. The history, it's not just sort of a bunch of old anecdotes and dusty stuff, but it's also a path. It served for the modern generation of bartenders and drink mixers. It served as a path to follow to learn how to do things right, because we lost so much during Prohibition and the years after in just the right way to make cocktails, to set up a bar, to run a bar, to, you know, all that stuff kind of got dumbed down. And finally, it's coming back, and you go to some of the top bars in the country. Some of them, and they're, you know, almost all of them are new, and you really see the level of service and dedication that it takes to do this. And that was really lacking. I mean, there were always great bartenders, but they kind of lacked the tools to make great drinks to go along with their bartending. And now you see them really. The drinks are as good as the chatter and the personality and so on and so forth. I think that's just great.
Should we just take an eraser to the 70s and part of the 80s, that whole historical cocktail
section?
Yeah, it
goes back into the 60s, too.
Well, what happened? I mean, aside from Prohibition, I mean, even shortly after Prohibition, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about what happened in sort of the dark ages of the cocktail in America, because I don't think it's as simple as Prohibition.
No, it's not. No, I agree.
We'll be back in just a moment talking with David Wondrich about cocktails in general and his wonderful new book, Imbibe. You can find more about it at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Stick with us. We'll be back in a moment. 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with David Wondrich about his book on cocktails called Imbibe. Now, we were talking before the break about the dark ages of the American cocktail. When did that start and why did it happen?
Well, it started in 1919 when Prohibition was passed and suddenly it became illegal to be a bartender. Some people continued to work illegally. Others went abroad or found other work. And that was a big problem because that broke the tradition. And, you know, with anything, there's always a struggle between tradition kind of holding the line, the way to do things right, and shortcuts and innovation. And once the traditions were gone, it was all shortcuts. The whole 20th century was shortcuts. There was sour mix. There were, premixed ingredients, they simplified the recipes, everything would be just served on the rocks or whatever. A martini on the rocks. I mean, how sad is that? Well, and that was the 60s.
Well, I'm sorry, a martini on the rocks with no vermouth.
With no vermouth,
that's
I know.
That's called a gin on the rocks.
Yeah, if you want a glass of gin, just order a glass of gin.
But
there's nothing wrong with that.
You know what we used to say in a bar I used to work in? People used to say, what's the difference between a martini and a gin on the rocks? And the answer was 50 cents.
I mean, really, that's it. So, you know, it's a bunch of everything that happened to American food and all that stuff in the late 20th century, that happened to cocktails,
but
too.
But it's funny. I mean, I remember going to a wedding in the 1970s and, you know, sneaking a whiskey sour at my friend Eric's bar mitzvah and thinking, that's gross. I'm a kid, and that's gross. Mm-hmm. Not because of the whiskey, but because of
the sour
stuff.
Yeah, it was. You know, I mean, that was what you would get. And you look back, you read like kind of accounts of the 40s, and they'd have huge parties for 400 people, and everyone would get an old fashioned. You know, it's not so hard.
You know, but
I mean, that's a reasonable drink.
And you know, I want to come back, and I want to talk about on the other side of the news. How that happened, because it's I don't know how you go from having a whiskey sour, which is actually an excellent drink made with egg white and lemon and lime and sugar and whiskey, and you know it's palatable and it's not even an underage person's drink, and how someone says, oh, here, try this instead, it's, you know,
and thinks that that's okay,
and that doesn't spit it out and say this is ridiculous. All right, we're going to come back after the news. We're going to be talking with David Wondrich. He's one of the great cocktail historians of our time. Stick with us. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're talking today with cocktail expert and historian David Wondrich about his book, Imbibe. If you want to find out more about it and maybe even order it, you can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. It's a fabulous, fabulous book. If you consider yourself a cocktailian, you must read it by the end of the week. That's your assignment.
Well, thanks.
David, we were talking before the break about how there was a tradition of great cocktails in America. The tradition of great cocktails was born here. And yes, Prohibition really knocked the legs out from under this great tradition we had created. But I don't understand how we got to the point where there was still a thirst for cocktails. I mean, people still went out for cocktails and happy hour in the 70s and 80s. I remember my sisters, who were 10 and 15 years older than I, would go out and have a whiskey sour. And I remember having a whiskey sour as a kid made with a chemical sour mix and thinking it was gross then, not because I didn't like whiskey, but because the sour was awful.
Yeah.
And then I remember being in 1986 was when I became a bartender, and I was bartending at a great place. And they sort of let me have free rein, and I wound up being their wine guy, ordering their wine and making their wine program go. But I really was fascinated with cocktails, and I got the old Mr. Boston Guide, which has since been re-edited by Anthony Giglio and is a wonderful book again.
Yeah, for the first time.
but I remember getting the Mr. Boston Guide, which was the only book behind the bar in 1986, and trying to make a bunch of sours.
And it was probably the Mr. Boston book from 1972.
Right.
Yeah.
But making the sours and fizzes and the drinks out of that and trying them and thinking, wow, that's just awful. And
why would anybody drink that?
And it wasn't just like, oh, this whiskey sour isn't as good as that whiskey sour. It's thinking, why would anybody ever drink this? How did we get to the point where cocktails, they convinced some of us that...
where cocktails were disgusting.
Where cocktails were disgusting. How did that happen?
Well, it's that, like, bad money drives out good. You know, the bad recipes are cheaper to make. There's less booze in them. There's more mixer. The mixer is crap. Excuse me. And it just, you see it happening with like cooking. It's like, you know, you take something as beautiful as pizza where you, put on, you make some dough and, put some fresh ground tomatoes on it and, a little bit of mozzarella. That's one thing. But then you get the mass market pizza, like the frozen pizzas with, where everything on it is artificial and those always taste bad.
So basically that whiskey sour to the real whiskey sour is what a pizza is to a Hot Pocket.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's something you always got to fight against. But I think for three generations there, bartenders didn't have the ammunition to fight against it.
Well, you know, one of the things that you talked about, having the tradition be the bulwark against that, and having your Italian grandmother be at home saying, no, you can't eat that stuff, that's awful, and then giving you real pizza, because it gives you your idea of how to hold on to that. We lost our tradition to a certain extent, and I remember when it was pointed out to me that there was such a thing, and I started working on regaining it, was when I was kind of a wine snob, and I had my own restaurant already at the time. I was 27 years old, and I plopped myself down at Dale DeGroff's bar at the Rainbow Room in 1993 or 92. Mm-hmm. We were introduced by a mutual friend, and there this guy, who had said to me when I'd met him out socially that he felt cocktails could be as complex as wine, and I was like,
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'll go sit at your little cocktail bar. And the man blew me away for 4 hours with cocktail after cocktail and then contextualized them. Yeah. I think one of the things that Dale does and that you do is, and the importance of this book, is it contextualizes these tastes. It rebuilds that tradition, not to keep it static, but so that people who want to learn this craft have these fundamentals to continue to be creative and move forward. Is that your goal?
Yeah, I think it's kind of about palate building. You know, the best bartenders in the days before Prohibition could rely on customers who would know a good drink when they tried one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't afraid of the taste of booze. They knew balance. They didn't. They knew like what it meant to make a good drink. And if you didn't make a good one, they would let you know. And we've kind of we totally lost that for generations. Nobody had a good drink. I mean, there were a few people here and there who could make them and would make them for special customers. But you know, there was really no place for that in the culture. And that's kind of what the contextualizing is about, is to kind of get people to try these drinks in the first place. If you tell them a good story and show them why that drink is important. And once you try them, and once you've built up a little bit of a palate, you know, the work is done. Then you know. You know, you've had a good drink. You know that it's not that hard to make one. You know that you should expect one. I think that's just great. I mean, that's the hard part for me.
Well, David, though, we talk about people just not knowing. For how many years did that grenadine stuff that we had in a bottle that you made a Shirley Temple out of for little kids was a real ingredient? I mean, I didn't know.
Yeah, no.
This is something you could actually use in a real cocktail?
I remember making a Jack Rose. When we talked about me first becoming a bartender, I remember making a Jack Rose, which was a drink that was in that cocktail book, and thinking, that's the most disgusting thing I've ever put in my mouth.
Sure, it was made with a grenadine and a sour mix.
Yeah,
and it was just.
But now we make a Jack Rose. It's on our cocktail list, and it's one of our most popular drinks. Talk to us about the ingredients and what happened.
Well, the sour mix is obviously a big thing, partly because it's artificially flavored. It's pre-sweetened, which is really bad, because that means you're never going to be able to add more sweet ingredients to balance it out. You can only add a little bit, and then you get a drink that's just disgustingly sweet.
Well, and you have a chemical frothing agent,
which
is delicious.
Exactly. No. Instead of using a natural egg white, which doesn't give you a chemical flavor or an egg white flavor, it just gives you creaminess and body. The frothing agent just gives you froth. It doesn't do anything else to the drink. And you've got, you know, it's an abysmal ingredient.
Well, and grenadine has gone.
And grenadine, too. Yeah, that's all high fructose corn syrup, with food coloring.
Well, don't forget red dye number 5.
Exactly.
You know, come on,
yeah,
that's a key ingredient.
And corn syrup.
Well, now we make our own grenadine, but talk to us about the original grenadines and
how
they're different from what's out there.
Originally, grenadine was a pomegranate-flavored syrup, you know, and they had... Well, I won't say they only had natural ways to do things, because the old bar books from the 19th century are full of scary-looking shortcuts if you wanted to be ruthless. But at the good places, you know, there were natural products available, and they would use them. They would use the good products, and they would use a fancy imported French syrup, a grenadine, made from pomegranate seeds and sugar and, you know, maybe a little bit of spice of some sort, and that would be it. It would be a natural product. And then you would, mix that with a lemon juice squeezed to order for every drink and some liquor that you had aging in barrels in your own basement, and you'd be done. You know, that's not so bad.
David, you're a historian, so you got to be the right person to ask this question. How do we go from a pomegranate syrup, which is grenadine, to a grenadine that doesn't even sniff pomegranates? How do we get from point A to point B?
How do people accept it?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I mean, I think mostly with grenadine, it's kind of a special case because grenadine was usually used just to sweeten the drink and add color, and they just use a little bit to make the drink pink, and that's the part that kept on.
You know, it's funny. We started making our own grenadine about 2 years ago, and some kid came and ordered a Shirley Temple.
Yeah.
I said, well, I don't have any of that other grenadine stuff. I'll just use it making our grenadine. I didn't even think about it, you know. And I did a little, and then I tasted it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a darn good drink.
There you go. See?
Shirley Temple.
Make it right.
Of course, I'm a boy, so it's a Roy Rogers when I drink it, right?
Yeah, of course. That's funny.
Well, listen, we're gonna take a quick break. We're gonna come back and talk more with David Wunderich about the state of the cocktail today, about his book and why you should pick it up. We have over 100 recipes in there, so we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:44.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. We're having a grand old time talking with our friend David Wondrich about his new book, Imbibe, From Absinthe Cocktail to the Whiskey Smash, A Salute in Stories and Drinks to Professor Jerry Thomas, Pioneer of the American Bar. Who's Jerry Thomas?
He's the guy who wrote the first Bartender's Guide. I mean, that's the short answer, which is, you know, in a way, that's enough. I mean, there had never been a Bartender's Guide before. He's the guy who got the art of the bar in between the covers of a book. But beyond that, he had just a wild life story, and he was kind of, you know, one of the great Americans. He was a sailor, a 49er, a showbiz impresario, a bit of an artist. He did everything. He was a fan of bare-knuckle boxing and sports betting, and he led a wild and sporty life.
And what have you imparted of him in this book, Imbibe?
I tried to capture the... a little bit of the kind of the swagger and the fun of the life that he was involved in, and I tried to get the good stories and the true ones in between the pages of a book, in between the covers of a book, to sort of bring to life this incredible bar culture and sporty culture that they had in the middle of the 19th century.
But even the great bartenders today, I find, they have an exciting life outside their bar job. They've done things, they've been to places, they're worldly. Those are the types of people who are the most interesting bartenders, aren't they?
I totally agree. It's not just mixing drinks. That's even the smallest part of it. You have to be a character, you have to be able to talk to people from all walks of life. You know, I've always admired a great bartender for that social versatility, that sense of dignity behind the bar, where, you know, you're in charge, and yet at the same time you're hospitable, and you're not, you know, you can handle people in all states of sobriety.
It's an unusual position in our society, and it always has been. Even when the cocktails were in decline, the bartender has a unique place in the social milieu. You know,
it's totally true. I mean, you know, I don't want people to think that, you know, that there were no good bartenders between 1920 and now. There were many of great bartenders. It's just
they weren't making good cocktails.
They weren't, and they might have been making a few good cocktails, but very few of them, you know, were set up to make like the whole range of great cocktails.
Now let's talk about cocktail range, because I think there are two sorts of cocktail bars out there right now.
Mm-hmm.
There are cocktail bars that are doing a mix of classic and new cocktails, or at least are doing new cocktails with a sense of the classic, where people are using different liquors and you taste the liquors in the cocktail. You taste a rum cocktail, you taste
absolutely
a whiskey cocktail, you taste, you know, bitters like or absinthe or herbaceous liquor ingredients, and those flavors are blended with other flavors. But there are also what's called the martini bars, where basically there are a lot of different colors of fruit juice flavored with vodka. Will you talk to us about that divide?
Yeah, it kind of goes back to the 90s, I think.
And first of all, do you think that's true?
I think to a large degree it's true, although I think some of the vodka bars, that's kind of mutated into its own school of mixology, which is particularly popular on the West Coast.
And describe that school of mixology.
And that's where they start with vodka, just a neutral spirit, and then they're bringing in all these garden flavors and kitchen flavors and kind of creating a new style of drink based on modern cooking and not on traditional American drinking. And it's interesting. It can be good, but I'm, as you can already tell, I'm
not crazy
about it.
That's not your school.
Yeah, it's not my school. I like things where you taste spirits and brandy and cognac and things like that.
What I was talking about was a school that does more, doesn't even bring in the kitchen, but they bring in De Kuyper apple pucker.
Yeah, that's just pathetic.
Ladies and gentlemen, there you have it from one of the foremost cocktail experts in the
that's
country.
That's not a school, it's a playground.
Yeah, exactly. Nicely put. I mean, but that's, you know, that's sort of, that comes out of the 80s and the 70s. You know, I remember Alabama Slammers and Kamikazes and all that. And you're kind of getting that where they're now taking them out of the shot glass and putting it in a cocktail glass because that looks sexier.
My rule of thumb is if you have to order your martini by color,
yeah.
Number one, it's not a martini, and number two, you're in the wrong place.
My rule of thumb is a martini is gin and vermouth, period.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
My rule of thumb is like the color of a martini is clear.
Yeah, exactly. you know.
Well, let's also talk about something that I think many of our listeners may not be aware of. Now, these cocktails that generally I find a lot of the old cocktails wind up being about 40% spirits, you know, 50% spirits, sometimes mm-hmm. more than that. But also the classic cocktails, the cocktail glasses that you talk about in Jerry Thomas's time, they were like a 3-ounce cocktail, right?
Yeah, they're tiny. You know, that's the whole idea. A lot of that kind of the teeny school, as you could call it, you know, with the apple pucker, et cetera, you get a huge glass full of liquid. Most of it is sour mix and ice melt and low proof liqueur, and there's maybe an ounce and a half, or in a good place they'll double it of actual liquor in your 12-ounce martini glass. Now, in the old days, you know, they made a very concentrated drink. It was the booze, the mixer, and only a little bit of mixer, really. There'd be the juice of half a lemon. That's like half an ounce of juice. Or you might mix half booze and half vermouth, but you'd only mix an ounce and a half of each.
The idea was to season the liquor, not to just hide it.
Exactly. But, and the idea was to have a concentrated, you know, truly tasty drink, one that you know, it wasn't like this big thing you were supposed to sip for a long time. It was a tonic. You were supposed to take it and drink it pretty quickly while it was still cold and feel braced and happy about it.
Hey, we're going to have to take a quick break. And mm-hmm. for those of you on the air, we're going to come back in just a moment or two. And then after the show, tonight when we put this up on podcast, we're going to spend a little more time talking with David Wondrich about his book. And you can go to restaurantguysradio.com and hear the rest of this wonderful interview with David Wondrich. For those of you on the air, we'll be back in just a moment. David, will you stick with us?
Absolutely. Gladly.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, for the online-only extended interview with David Wondrich. So, I'm sorry. We were talking right before that little break about cocktail sizes. One of the other things about the cocktail size today, I see now 12 and sometimes 14-ounce martini glasses.
Oh,
and
God.
They make me crazy. Well, I'll tell you something that's interesting. When they first came out, I liked them. And I mm-hmm. still think that they're sort of a stylish statement. If you put a 4.5 or 5-ounce cocktail in a 12-ounce martini glass, it's kind of cool.
Well, yeah, you're not going to spill, for one thing.
Right. Well, that was sort of the same
kind of feel that you have when you have an oversized wine
glass.
Yeah,
it was the size of it. Yeah. But what's happened is, and people fill them all the way. And first of all, I think, well, if you have a real drink, who the heck wants 12 ounces at a time? And secondly, by the time you're halfway through with that thing, it's warm.
Yeah, you can't. You can't drink a real martini or a vodka martini or whatever in that size and expect to remain unmarked by the experience.
Right. If you do, you're going to be messy.
Yeah, it's instant intoxication in a glass, and it gets warm and disgusting halfway through, and it's not, you know, it's not economical for a an establishment either. You could sell one of those for a premium price because it's big, but you could sell two smaller cocktails for almost twice as much. You know?
What do you think in today's day and age is the right size of a cocktail glass for a cocktail that is partially, you know, juice or mixer and partially spirits served up?
I look for like a 5-ounce glass.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. We have a 6.5-ounce cocktail glass.
That'll work fine.
And
yeah.
We serve 5 ounces of cocktail in it. And what we know is that just under 4 ounces of mix shaken with ice
yeah.
yields us a perfect 5-ounce cocktail.
And yeah, that's perfect.
And for an all-liquor cocktail, we generally serve about 4.5 ounces in 4 ounces in a 5 ounce glass.
Yeah.
But do you really want more than 4 ounces of martini, which is 3 ounces of gin?
I certainly don't. You know, that's because I'm old.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you the thing that I can't stand when I go to one of these places is when they fill up my drink so much that I got to do the lean over the bar and take the first little slurp off the top, or I'm getting cocktail in my lap. One of those, you know, yes, okay, you got a 9 ounce glass and you filled it up to the tippy top, but if you had given me 7.5 ounce drink, I'd have been happier.
Yeah.
And less messy.
Yeah, it's more elegant. You don't need all the extra booze, frankly.
It's just going to end up in my lap anyway.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. Yeah, it's pointless. I don't even actually like the conical martini glass very much.
Now
I like the champagne coupe because it doesn't spill.
Well, we use the champagne coupe for juice cocktails, and we use the up martini glass, the conical martini glass for cocktails that are basically all liquor.
Yeah.
If you fill that not all the way, why do you like the coupe better? I mean, the coupe is more traditional, right?
Well, it's just because if you have a slightly larger conical glass, then it's not a problem. But it's because of the spilling factor. You know, I like the way the coupe, the sides suddenly go up vertically, and so stuff doesn't come flushing out nearly so easily.
Plus, I'm drinking.
Exactly. and, you know, if I'm in a bar, I'm talking, I'm waving my arms around, I'm generally behaving in a gregarious and slightly insane manner, and, you know.
I've seen you. I've been there.
It's a frightening thing, but what can you do?
Now, talk to us about an issue that one of the things that I also remember that Dale introduced to me many years ago that I see all the time. I actually saw Tony Abuganim do it on Iron Chef. Iron Chef had some mixologists recently on a recent show.
I remember that.
A mixologist assigned to each chef, and Tony used the old, it's become classic now, the flamed orange peel garnish on top of a cocktail.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time Dale did that. I thought it was so cool. First of all, I'm pyromaniac. I love anything.
Exactly.
But talk to us about traditional garnishes and extraneous garnishes.
Well, traditionally, the garnish was a part of the drink. There's my doorbell. I'm going to ignore that. Traditionally, the garnish
it's the,
was...
It's the vodka companies. They're coming after.
Yeah, exactly. it was part of the drink, and it was there, like a lemon peel is there to get a slick of lemon oil on the surface of the drink so that it will be the first thing that hits your nose, and it will be, you know, give you this kind of pleasant, appetizing sensation. And it wasn't there just so you, like, you didn't just cut a curl of lemon peel and throw it in. You had to get the oil on the surface of the drink, and that was a that was important. You know, it's integral to the drink. So you know, the cherry maybe less so, but that was there to give you a little treat. There's a long tradition of putting berries and things like that in a fancy drink, just to kind of give you a little something in addition to the liquid. But they were always fresh berries. The original maraschino cherries were simply sour cherries marinated in maraschino liqueur.
You know, we actually have in our bar now, we have sour cherries marinated in maraschino liqueur. It's a way to put up local cherries.
Yeah.
And it adds to the drink. And I found that using maraschino cherries in a couple of drinks that we've invented, even muddling them in the bottom, those are really an important part of the drink. They're not just there for looks.
I think the basic thing that we're all agreeing with is the garnish isn't just there to be a pretty little umbrella on the side of a cocktail.
No.
It's part of the cocktail and should be
thought
of
that way. Yeah, it's an ingredient. You have to think of it as an ingredient. How is it going to work with the other things? I mean, some of my favorite garnishes are to, like, for instance, just drip a little bit of bitters on top of a like an all liquor drink,
like or a pisco sour,
or yeah, exactly, yeah. Where you drip it on and then they kind of make weird patterns as they slowly soak in, and it looks cool. It gives you some visual interest, but it also adds to the flavor of the drink.
Well, I'll be honest. Some of my favorite garnishes are still those little umbrellas, but that's a whole separate issue.
Yeah, well, there's the whole tiki drink thing, which adds the element of fun. And
Mark's got a collection of those little umbrellas at home. We don't talk about it very much. All right, so I want to give people a little more of a teaser into your book. I mean,
we've got
a bunch of great recipes in there, but you also talk about the evolution of some drinks that we know, like the Manhattan or the margarita. Can you give us the history of one of those drinks and how it came to be?
Well, let me talk about the margarita quickly, because that's a fun one. There's always been this big mystery about who invented the margarita, right? And it's their various stories. It was Mrs. Margarita Sames or Soames in Mexico, or it was a bartender here or there. But the funny thing about it is in the 19th century, there was a class of drink that you made by taking liquor and sweetening it with an orange liqueur or a different liqueur and adding some citrus juice to it, and that was called a daisy. And you would top that off with a little splash of seltzer. Now, daisy in Spanish is margarita. And a margarita is basically a tequila daisy without the seltzer. And it goes back to, you know, mid-19th century bartending. David? And if you look at old Spanish drink books, they have categories of daisies in there that say that are called margaritas. It's very funny.
But this is why the history is so important to what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because these things are related, they are interrelated, and there are relationships between these ingredients that the test of time has proven work.
Yeah.
And bringing these things together and having bring them in historical context really shows you all of those things.
It helps you to kind of see the connections between the drinks, which helps you to remember the drinks, for one thing. It helps you to invent new drinks because you've got, like, frameworks that you can use in. It's not just random combinations of ingredients. You know what works with what, and these always work together, and there's usually a reason. It's useful. It's not just academic knowledge. And also it gives you something to tell your customer.
Yeah,
about
true.
A drink.
But you know what? People
love the stories.
You know the funny thing about it with food and especially with cocktails, it's like when people buy wine, they want to know where it came from. They want to know what the weather was like. They want to know what the soil
exactly.
is like. They want to know the story of the family that owns the vineyard. And with cocktails, there is a similar history. You know, eating is a very seminal thing. It's part of history that with eating and drinking that we take
mm-hmm.
into us, and it's part of our culture, and it really should be celebrated and imbibed as a great contribution to that. David, and I want to thank you for writing it. And
well, thank you for reading it. It's much appreciated, and thank you for having me on the show.
It was great, David.
It's a ton of fun to talk to you. I'm sure that we'll see you around a cocktail bar.
I'm looking forward to it.
In the area very soon.
Thanks very much, David.
David Wondrich's book is Imbibe. You can find out more about it on our website. There's a foreword by our friend Dale DeGroff. And pick it up. You are assigned to read it by next week. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. I could talk to him for a week, and we're going to talk to him online afterwards.
You probably have talked to him for a week
if you meet David out anywhere, I've met him making cocktails, and he can make cocktails and talk at the same time. And we've had drinks together at a few events. He's an encyclopedia of knowledge, and he's fun. He's fun.
Well, we were talking earlier in the show about the great bartenders, and one of the things in teaching young men and women to be bartenders that Francis and I always have to do is we have to teach people to engage the people that are ordering the drinks while they're making the drinks. Because what happens is, without fail, somebody who's new at this, somebody who's not done it for a long time, goes to the end of the bar, will take a drink order and be very pleasant while they take the drink order, and then be so focused on making the drink that we're talking about that they've lost connection to the customer.
Yeah. Bartending is an art that I think bartending, the non-cocktail part of bartending never really died.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there were always great bartenders.
That's true.
There was a guy named John who, I don't know if I should use his last name or not, because John, who was a bartender mm-hmm. at J. August, which is now defunct, who I thought was a great bartender. And I said, you know, I want to have a bar just like John's because of the social dynamic that he created in his bar. Now, was he making classic cocktails and doing great cocktails? No, but I'll tell you what he did. No, and there were always bartenders that knew about scotch and knew their products, and they weren't making cocktails with them that were anyways decent. And I remember that, you know, John, I can say his name, John Seiler, was a great bartender. And I remember I sat down at his bar as a very young man when I first started bartending, years before I met Dale DeGroff, and John Seiler explained to me single malt scotch.
Mm-hmm.
And my mouth was open, and I thought, oh my, I gotta know about this stuff.
I remember working with a guy way back when, a guy's name was Mooney. And Mooney could talk to anybody about anything. He knew, he could recall every sporting event that had ever been. He was a historian. He knew a little bit about everything. and he could talk to anybody and produce some new piece of information.
Mark and I used to work behind the bar once in a while when we worked at another place, and people would come in, they'd want to talk about the ballet. Mark would be like, hold on a second, let me get Francis. People would come in and want to talk about football, I'd be like, you, wait right here, hold on a second, the other guy will be over in a second. Anyway, so it's kind of like a radio show. Hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. We certainly have. You can go to restaurantguysradio.com and hear the extra interviews we're about to do with David Wunderch. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. Time is 12 noon.